Today in Europe. This is the time of day when the Columbia Broadcasting System brings you news from abroad. And now this is Bob Trout in New York about to call in CBS representatives for reports direct from Europe. First, Finan reports code experts of the Foreign Office are standing by for an important message from Moscow, where the Russian-Finnish negotiations are still going forward at an early hour of the morning. Now for the news from the capital of Germany, a report by Russell Hill, CBS representative there. Go ahead, Berlin.
Good evening. This is Russell Hill in Berlin. The National Socialist Government's war against the Jews of Germany has not been stopped by the bigger war against England and France. At least that's the way it looks tonight after an official announcement that an additional levy will be raised on the property of Jews here as a part of the fine they incurred last November. You will probably remember the decision to require the Jews to pay 1 billion marks as a punishment because a 17-year-old Polish Jew had killed a Nazi consular official in Paris. The fine was to be collected by assessing every Jew 20% of his total property. Fortunes under 5,000 marks were exempted. The money was to be paid in 4 installments, the last of which fell due on August 15th of this year. If the Jews thought that on that date that they had completed payment, they were mistaken. According to today's announcement, the 20% quota has been raised to 25%. Therefore, a 5th installment will be necessary, and it is to be collected by November 15th. That leaves just 23 days in which to raise the money. The reason given for this additional tax is that the previous amounts paid did not add up to 1 billion marks, $400 million in American money according to the official exchange rate. It is reliably reported that it fell short by a little over a quarter of a billion marks. Should the November payment still be insufficient, there are 2 methods which may be used to raise the balance. Either rich Jews may be approached for additional contributions, or the small fortunes of less than 5,000 marks may be tapped. There was no indication here that the Nazis would call it quits before the full billion marks had been paid in. It is assumed that the additional 5% will be figured on the basis of last November's valuation, because nothing has been said about revaluating the property. That may make it difficult in some cases to raise the money, because since the beginning of this year, Jews have been forbidden to own or operate any retail business, export firm, mail order house, or handicraft enterprise. Consequently, the total value of their property since a year ago has undoubtedly decreased. The Nazis blame the Jews for many of the economic troubles of Germany since 1914. In connection with the present war, the press has brought out on numerous occasions the conviction that the Jews were largely responsible for Germany's losing the last war. It is pointed out that Jews filled many important economic and commercial and also administrative posts at that time. The National Socialist thesis is that they were largely to blame for the collapse of the home front. That charge is grave, because it is maintained here that the soldiers on the battlefront held firm and would have won the war if the country had not collapsed internally. Germany's war chances are now rated much higher in official circles here, in large part because Jews no longer wield positions of influence. This is Russell Hill in Berlin, returning you to Columbia in New York.
That was Berlin, and now here's news that we have just received here in New York. A report reaching the United States lines in New York tonight says that the liner City of Flint, owned by the United States government, was captured by a German surface raider. This unconfirmed report, attributed to United States Lines official in New York, adds that the 4,963-ton ship chartered by the line was forced to haul down its American flag and replace it with the Nazi swastika. Then the report adds, the city of Flint was taken to a port on the Norwegian east coast, where the vessel remained until this evening. She was then reported taken in tow by a German armed vessel, which escorted her to an unknown point. Attempts to confirm this report officially in New York at the office of the United States Lines and the office of the United States Shipping Board have failed, but it was said the details of the city of Flint's encounter at sea were being rushed down to Washington. We repeat, this report so far is entirely unconfirmed. Now for the news from the British capital, where naval and aerial activity was also reported today. Edward R. Murrow will now report from London. Go ahead, London.
This is London. There is a possibility that Britain may experience her first strike of the war next week. A conference between North Wales mine operators and the mine workers ended in deadlock tonight. Unless there is a settlement before next Saturday, when the agreement expires, there will be a general strike in the coal field on Monday. A demand for higher wages is only one of the concessions asked by the workers. The owners say the finances of the companies will not stand a greater strain. The Air Ministry announced two attacks by Royal Air Force planes on enemy submarines. Both are believed to have been successful. Patches of oil and underwater explosions were observed after a salvo of bombs forced the submarines to dock. London was told tonight of the work of the Royal Air Force in convoying merchant ships. Twice, airmen have prevented convoys from striking floating mines. It seems that those mines are hard to see in rough weather. In one instance, the planes dropped smoke flares to mark the location of the mines. Another time, a fast destroyer, warned by planes, was able to cut across in front of the convoy and explode the mine by gunfire. Two more British merchantmen have been sunk. The 1,300-ton Sea Venture went down off the north coast of Scotland. The White Mantle, a ship of 1,600 tons, was lost in the North Sea. It is not clear whether those two ships were lost as a result of mines, planes, or submarines. Here's a story that comes from a British airport 3 or 4 minutes behind the Maginot Line. Bill Henry, Columbia's war correspondent, was watching what he calls a rather comic football game between French and British soldiers. He tells of a Royal Air Force patrol coming back from the front line, of the pilots doing a certain amount of stunting over the field. But he saw one pilot who came and taxied up to the line, climbed out, stripped off his fur-lined flying suit, looked at the right wing of his ship, and walked away. Mr. Henry walked over and looked where the pilot had looked. Right through the wing, he says, there were two holes, one not more than 18 inches from the cockpit. Nobody had to tell me that they weren't made by woodpeckers or worms. Looks like you had a pretty close call, I said to the pilot. The tall, blonde fellow turned to me, grinned, and said, so near, and yet so far. I didn't have to ask him why he hadn't participated in the stunting when the flight returned. I knew. The report that Stalin has refused Air Hitler's request for military aid in the form of 2,000 airplanes is still without confirmation so far as we know in London, although it was prominently headlined here throughout the day. Here's another story that is without confirmation. It's about the reestablishment of a monarchy. Mr. Duff Cooper's prediction upon his arrival in New York of an early right-wing revolution in Germany, probably resulting in the restoration of the monarchy, is coupled with reports here from a Paris newspaper that a number of high German army officers have been removed for supporting the restoration of a monarchy. That report, it seems, originated with the Zurich correspondent of a Paris paper. So far as I know, the monarch has not yet been nominated by official, unofficial, well-informed, or usually reliable sources. Now for the news from Thomas Grattan in Paris. Go ahead, Paris.
This is Paris. Observers here still seem to think that Germany will concentrate all effort on attacking England by means of airplanes and submarines because an offensive against the French frontier would be so difficult. I've been talking to a lot of people about this question of the turn the war will take now that the partition of Poland is a fact. I wonder if you remember a man named Gio, head waiter at the Café de la Paix, who talked over the Columbia Network some weeks before the war began in a program called France Looks at America. Well, I went to see him today and had a talk. His son is at the front. He said, we men who went through the last war can't understand this one. It's an entirely different matter now. And another man said to me a few hours ago, my son is wounded. I only wish I could be in his place. It would be easier. But nobody seems to understand the war. It's just a matter of suffering now and in the future. It's like an economic crisis that surpasses understanding. It's worse than a depression, perhaps, but it's no less difficult to put your finger on. You can't just say it ruins my life and the life of the people whom I know. You can't just say if so-and-so were put out of the picture, everything would be all right. It's bigger than people. That's the truth of the world we live in. Our troubles are bigger than our minds. This is Thomas Grattan returning you now to Columbia in New York.
That was Paris. And now for the news from our own capital city, where the neutrality debate went into its fourth week on Capitol Hill as Democratic leaders in Congress began the drive to end this special session. For the report of Albert Warner, we take you now to Washington.
For the moment, there is no report here yet of the alleged capture of the American vessel City of Flint by a German surface raider off Norway. Such an event would undoubtedly figure in the neutrality debate. Of course, under the administration bill, no American ship would be going to Britain and France if the bill became law. Probably the president would also declare all northern Europe, including Norway and Sweden, a danger zone, and no American ship would be venturing into those waters. It was another bitter day of combat on the Senate floor today. At the end, although this was the beginning of the fourth week of talk, no truce in this war of words was yet arranged. Again late this afternoon, the administration failed to obtain unanimous Senate agreement to limit debate on the neutrality bill. Majority Leader Barkley made the request. That veteran isolationist, Senator Hiram Johnson, made the objection. But even High Johnson held out the hope of an armistice. He said he wished time first to call a meeting tomorrow of all the oppositionists to repeal of the arms embargo. Barkley was visibly annoyed at the delay. He served notice in effect that if no agreement were reached, the administration would consider that a filibuster was in progress. In that event, he said, senators had better cancel any social engagements for tomorrow night. He meant the process of wearing down speakers would be invoked. Earlier in the day, both the Democratic and Republican leaders of the Senate and Vice President Garner had been confident enough of the course ahead. They visited the White House and told the president that a final vote was likely by Friday. As a matter of fact, that is still the outlook. Passage of the bill in the Senate is assured. The real battle may be in the House. A commentary on the situation is that High Johnson spied in the back of the Senate chamber Representative Joe Martin, Republican leader of the House, and talked with him for 15 minutes. Martin is still silent on his position, but the majority of his House Republicans, with the aid of a minority of Democrats, stand as a threatening group to the embargo repeal. Martin says in any case he will oppose early adjournment. If there is emergency enough for a special session, it is sufficiently great for Congress to stay here and see that America's security is not endangered, he said. Senator Wiley, the Wisconsin Republican, a patient listener to every one of the 41 speeches in the Senate, came out of the doubtful list today. He said he would vote against repeal, but he did it solely on the basis he thought Wisconsin sentiment trended in that direction. Then there was a flare-up over the Hyde Park church service, which President Roosevelt attended yesterday. The Reverend Mr. Wilson had said a prayer for King George of England. Democratic Senator Clark suggested that an American prayer book might better have been used. We return you now to New York.
That was Washington, a report by Albert Warner, CBS representative in the nation's capital. Earlier during this broadcast, we heard reports from Russell Hill, who reported from Berlin, Edward R. Murrow in London, and Thomas B. Grandin reporting the news from Paris. Now, just a reminder that at 8:55 Eastern Time, Columbia brings you the nightly broadcast of Elmer Davis and the news. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.